Hello, this is Claire Levy. Coming up in this edition of the DRWF podcast, Living with Diabetes, I'm speaking with Simon McKee, who's been living with type 1 diabetes for over 50 years. Following a career in investment banking, he now provides support for the emotional and mental health impact of diabetes.
You know, as you pick up, I've gone through quite a journey on this road. I suddenly went from I can't to I can. I can do this. In that moment, I sort of, rather than, oh, this is a diet and I've got to do this and I've got to do this is who I am. But that mindset is so important. And if you're in a position where you're struggling, I'd say go talk to a counselor, go talk to somebody, or come do one of my workshops. And I deal an awful lot with this stuff.
Hear the full interview coming up next.
Views, information, or opinions contained in podcasts do not necessarily represent the opinions, standards, or policies of DRWF. The inclusion of details about products or services does not indicate DRWF endorsement of them. The aim of podcasts is to educate and inform, and we endeavour to ensure that the information provided in them is accurate. It's not a substitute for medical or health advice from a healthcare professional who's aware of the facts and circumstances of your individual situation. We always recommend that advice be sought from your GP or diabetes nurse before making any changes to medication or before using any products or services referenced by DRWF. Neither DRWF nor any of its employees or owners shall be held liable or responsible for the accuracy or completeness for any errors or omissions in podcasts or for any damage you may suffer as a result of failing to seek competent medical or health advice from a professional who is familiar with your situation.
My name's Simon McKee, so I've been living with type 1 diabetes since I was 3 years old, and I'm now 56. It's over 50 years. And through that period, yeah, I've gone through some very highs and very lows with my control, sort of to the point where I did get a red flag, and that changed, had a big impact and changed my life. And that was probably about 16 years ago, ballpark. I live in London. I moved here in 97. I work in investment banking. I used to work in investment banking. I got out just as the pandemic was hitting. And I now run a company called Diabetes Take Control. And I deal with emotional and mental health side of diabetes and living with it, as well as other options, sort of how parents deal with it, how professionals talk to diabetics, and such as that. And then I also do a lot of public speaking to build awareness around diabetes, from, you know, just living with it to people who are working with diabetics, what to look out for, that sort of stuff. And yeah, so that's me.
Talk about your early diagnosis, would you?
So the early diagnosis, I was three. I have no idea what happened or what was going on. Now, I've got a twin brother as well who didn't get it. So my mum noticed with me, and I suppose she had a parallel as well with, you know, there was two identical kids and one of them was kind of drinking a huge amount of fluids, constantly going to the toilet, and was having mood swings. And she kind of picked up pretty quickly on that and was on it very quickly, I have to say. So I had my diagnosis very, very quickly, and that was it. So I don't remember life pre-diabetes. My earliest memories are being called into the house, been, you know, having a pair of elasticated pants and rolling over my mum's knee with my bum shown, and she'd jam me in the back of the bum with an injection, and then we'd have dinner. Or, you know, that was my memories, early memories of it. And we also used to use, that was the other thing, I remember glass syringes. So you had to boil these things. Now, thank God, Beckett Dickinson introduced plastic disposable needles or syringes shortly afterwards. So I only was subjected to that for a month or two, which was great. And then the urine test or the blood test didn't exist. So it was like a urine test. And it was like this chemistry kit. And you'd take a urine sample, drop it in, add a tablet, stir it up. And then it would start bubbling up and turn a color. And I think if I remember, blue was, you're all right. And then It only told you if you were high, didn't tell you if you were low. And then it would go sort of from blue to a grungy dark brown, and that would tell you you're high. And yeah, so I remember that chart in the inside of the door, and I'd open it up and I'd sort of try and connect it.
So your mum had loads to do there.
Oh my God, she was full on, full
Yeah.
on. And you know, even sort of a dinner or dinner, anytime we were eating, you know, all my siblings refer to me as the golden boy because I'd always get my food first. But it was literally because she had to weigh and measure everything. So I think it was like, get him out of the way, and then I can relax.
How many of you are there?
There were four of us.
Right.
So like, it was kind of full on. Like, but like there was myself and my brother, and then my younger sister's in a year and a half younger. And then my older sister's 5 years older. So there's a lot of kids running around going mad. And you know, we grew up in a neighborhood where, you know, if you had a friend in, he'd be getting lunch as well. And so, you know, there could be quite easily seven or eight kids at the table.
How did your brother take it over the years? Does he talk about it, or have medical professionals looked at your gene, your
Yeah,
identity, you think?
we have done a number of studies over the years where they've looked at diabetics globally, who are twins, and tried to distinguish is there any difference. Now, they never came back to us with anything. He would bitch and moan at the fact that he had to get a couple of blood tests. And I'm like, listen, I get this done every couple of months, on top of all the injections every day. But I think it impacted him a little bit in that he used to be a little bit of a hypochondriac when he was a kid. And I think that was to get attention because he might have felt I was getting all the attention, because of the diabetes. So certainly he's not like that anymore, but there was an element of that, you know, on my knee with this or that. So I think that was a little bit of competition, potentially looking for attention from mum.
So, what about your? You talked about your mum taking control. You've said to me about she would remind me, you're just like everyone else. So, can you talk a little bit about that?
She was incredible, because, you know, she's just used to do it very gently. So we might be walking from school or we might be just passing by, and she'd just say to me, "You're as good as everybody else. Your diabetes doesn't stop you doing anything you want. You can achieve all your goals. You're just the same as everyone. You just have to take a little bit more care." And she gave me like a real drive, and she'd always just like, yeah, I can't say it was like it, but it was frequent. It was always, she'd always say something like that, and it'd just motivate me and keep me sort of grounded with the diabetes that this is just something you've got. It's not going to define your life. It's not going to change you. It's not going to say to you, you can't do anything. You can just move on and be as good as everybody else, but you're just slightly different. And with that, she was quite incredible because she gave me a really strong mindset and a really independent mindset. So it's quite sort of interesting when I see, sometimes like when I go to this sort of coffee shop or something like that, and I'll see a small child who's a diabetic with their mum, or they might reach for you know, a candy bar or something like that. And you know, parents react in various different ways, but quite frequently I see they're incredibly strict. You can't do that. You can't touch that. You're not having that. Whereas my mum would always sit and explain and take the time to sort of let me understand why I can't have that. And as a result of that, I never really rebelled. And, you know, I remember sort of talking to a girl a couple of years ago, and she was 19, type one, and she was blind. And she was blind because she kind of rebelled, but she'd sort of said, like, it was so controlling. Everything I did, I couldn't move, and my mum was all over me, and I just rebelled, and I just didn't do it. But I didn't realize the damage I was actually doing. So I think that's so. It's an important thing to reflect on. But my mum nailed it. She got it bang on. So she was quite incredible. She was a big influence. Because my dad, I have to say, God love him, he was brilliant in so many ways. But when it came to the diabetes, he had no idea. And, you know, I always laugh at a memory of him where I'm in London, I'm 28, And I'm sitting there with my mum and my dad, and I pick up an apple to eat it. And he turns around to my mum and he goes, Can he eat that? And my mum was like, ask him. But
28.
yeah,
It
I just
wasn't
thought
a puffy
it
apple then.
was just your standard Granny Smith, you know?
Yeah.
But it was just, he never really kind of engaged on it. He was
No.
always there. He was always
Yeah.
my presence. And in many ways, he had a big impression on me. Because, he got polio when he was about 26. So he was a great inspiration in that nothing stopped him. So, he was in the Air Corps, and he got thrown out of the Air Corps, and he then went off and did a Harvard business degree, an MBA, got into business and just flew. And he was there. I always remember him with a walking stick. I never remember him before that. And he kind of just didn't care. But he was a great inspiration from that perspective, because I just looked at that and went, "You can do anything." So it was phenomenal. Yeah, really. Two very important people in my life, I have to say.
So what about these incredible physical challenges that you've taken on? Can you tell us more about those?
Yeah, I put them really. I think my mum had a lot to do with that, just that sense of independence. So from a young age, I was always engaged. I actually, what happened to me is at a young age, I read a sort of children's version of Around the World in 80 Days. And it blew my mind. And I was like, I want to go see all of these places. So when I think it was 29, I just picked myself up and decided I'm setting off around the world on my own for, I think I went for about 9 or 10 months. And I remember getting a train because I had to fly from Manchester. And I got the train up to Manchester, and I stayed in a horrible hotel just beside the train station. So I was going to bed and I was like, what am I doing? And then I flew out to India. But as I traveled, I sort of met all sorts of different people, and they were talking to me about all sorts of trips and adventures. And whilst I did that journey, I did sort of trips out in the outback in the middle of nowhere. I was sort of a couple of parachute jumps, bungee jumps. So I started to get an appetite for a different type of life. I grew up on the coast in a town called Howth, which is a sort of big fishing village with a very big yacht club. And I thought, I want to cross an ocean. So I remember sort of seeing this advertisement in the Sunday Times. And I thought, I'm going to do that. Now, I actually said, I'm going to do that with my wife. And I told her about this, and I rang Clipper, and they were like, yeah, that's great. We'd love to talk to you. So when I told her that, she started laughing. And she goes, she kept just going, you've met me, right? You've met me. So yeah, I did Clipper, and I sort of decided to do just two legs. I didn't want to do a whole around the world. So I did the Pacific leg, and then the leg from the Pacific through to the Atlantic via the Panama Canal. And it was phenomenal. And then on top of that, sailing actually gave me an appetite for climbing. So I then started to do an awful lot of climbing, and I've sort of humped it out to Everest Base Camp. And I did a lot of climbing when I was en route there, which was fantastic. And that's also given me a drive to this a mountain there called Meru Peak, which I haven't told my wife just yet, but I am planning to potentially summit that next year. And it's about, I don't know, I think it's about 6,900 meters. So it's not in the death zone, so she can't complain. But I just want to get up. I have this dream of just standing on a mountain above the clouds and just having a look. And if you've ever been to the Himalayas, it is absolutely breathtaking. And so it's phenomenal. Yeah. So I'm definitely that's on the cards. I don't know how I'm going to break that to her. Maybe I'm going golfing in South Africa for 2 weeks,
Right.
and then I'll call her from the summit, tell her I'm okay.
So all these challenges, incredible. How do you manage your diabetes whilst these things are going on?
Blood testing. So there was no Dexcoms really available. And to be honest, like, I think when you cross the Pacific, the possibility of using a Dexcom or one of those CGMs is probably quite tricky. because, you know, things don't charge as they would at home. So blood tests. And the thing with the blood test is it gives you complete accuracy on the assumption it's a good monitor. I mean, some of them are terrible, but if you have a good one, test your blood sugars. Constantly test your blood sugars. And I would always, anytime I go traveling now, even with the Dexcom, I will take three or four blood glucose monitors because stuff goes wrong. Like, it's amazing. Batteries run out, you drop it in the water, it gets crushed, somebody stood on it, somebody lost it. So you just need lots and lots of packs. You got to keep recording as well, is very important to actually record what's happening. So I use a thing now called a glucograph, and I use that to record all my blood sugars.
Is that on your phone or a
No, it's not on the phone. It's actually a little bit bigger than an A4 size paper. If anyone wants one, you can actually just go to Google and just type in glucograph. But I use that to record everything. And because you're writing it, you become very conscious of what's actually happening, as opposed to recording it digitally. And you'll start to see sort of small things that may occur. There's a theme. So, for example, like if I take tea with cream rather than milk, because there's a lot less lactose, so it doesn't impact the blood sugars. But if I have cream, too much cream, the blood sugars start to go up. And they do that because I kind of guess I get inflammation. And the glucograph will tell me that. Now, the other side to that as well is insulins. How do you look after insulins? So, across the North Pacific, the temperature's around 2 degrees to zero. That's usually okay for the insulins. But when I was in the Arctic, I did a couple of weeks in the Arctic with a sledge and a pack of dogs. So we'd been on the move for about 3 weeks, and it gets very cold. And even in the Everest base camp, when we had a couple of nights there where it dropped to minus 20, 25. So with that, you need to keep the insulin close to your body. And you've got to make sure you're layered up. So I used to actually sleep with the insulin when I was in Everest Base Camp. And when I traveled with the insulin in on the sledges in the Arctic, I had a sort of special pack that I got designed, and I'd stick all of the insulins in, and they'd stick on my chest, and then just keep it quite warm at a good temperature. And that sort of works. Because the thing is as well, you just need backups as well, because on both of those, in the Himalayas and also in the Arctic, at HQ, I left insulin there just in case anything happens or it froze, because if it freezes, it's gone. But, you know, there's guys who have summited Everest and they've done that, you know, so it can be done. But you gotta plan, and you gotta plan for every potential scenario, lots of them which you won't even be aware of.
And do you tell everybody you're with that you're living with type one?
Yeah, so it's very important. It's very, very important. And actually, when I do presentations to work, I always say get a buddy that you can talk to and tell them you're a diabetic. You don't have to tell the world, but make sure you tell one or two people. And it's important for them to know, because if you start to have a hypo, they need to be aware. Okay, this is what's happening, and this is what I need to do, or this is what's happening. This is going to be. We're going to be in this state for a couple of minutes. I need to go do X, Y, and Z. So certainly, like when I was on the Clipper, and we hit those very big storms, you know, I used to have like sort of two lifelines on, and I just sort of said to the guys, like, if anything happens, I've got Lucozade with me. So I always had a bottle with me in in my fellies, and I can just sit there, no matter what. It's coming through the bear, whatever's happening. I could just sit there and drink that Lucozade, and give me 5, 10 minutes, and I'll be back up and running. And that's pretty much how it operated, and it worked well. But also, I knew, and everyone else knew, this is where his store of Lucozade is. This is his backup store of Lucozade. If we haven't got the Lucozade, we can give him sweets. We've got a load of sweets here. So we were well covered, and we had no issues, actually, no issues at all, which was pretty phenomenal, I thought. So I think I had one mild hypo in 32 days across the Pacific. That was it. And the same in the Himalayas. I just had one hypo on the very last day, literally just as I got to the finish line. had a massive hypo, and I had to sit there for about 10 minutes.
Sorting yourself out.
Yeah, but it was, yeah, but yeah, that's it. So it's very important that you tell people. And the other side as well is when you tell people, they're very funny. They'll sit very rationally with you and they'll say, okay, I understand that. Yeah, okay, that's, I need to do this. Okay, that's great. Okay, I get that. And then when it happens, they're running around like headless chickens, screaming and shouting at each other, going, help, help. And I remember one such occasion, like as a kid in school, all the kids that I used to go to school with, they all knew. And I was having a huge hypo to the point where I was actually hallucinating. And the guys just, I mean, they were a disaster. The absolute disaster. So I literally managed to crawl my way to a news agent's, and I just dropped to the floor and started eating chocolate from one of the display units. And of course, the guy's like, excuse me, what's going on? So yeah, you got to be aware of that as well. So I would suggest in picking the people you tell, make sure there's somebody who's kind of calm in those sort of hairy moments. But yeah, it is important, and especially in work, I think it's super important. And even in work, to have backups and everything in a drawer, and that person knows where that is, and they know what to do. And yeah, that's it.
What about managing when you didn't have any tech?
Yeah, I mean that's kind of a bit of a story. So, my mum, as I was describing, she looked after it for really up until I was probably about 10, and I started injecting myself. And then as I started to go into secondary school, I would take over little bits of it. She'd hand it over. And then I actually went to what you guys call public school. So I was in boarding school in a place called Blackrock College. But when I was there, I really had to manage it. And I wasn't bad. I wasn't bad. And then I kind of went to university and I studied and I became an accountant. Don't tell anyone. But I got the fact anyway as an accountant. And then I came to London and I started working in investment banking, and it was fast. It was hard paced. I was in my 20s. It was great. It was just fantastic. And I started to, I was doing well. And with that, I was going out an awful lot more. We were constantly in restaurants and bars 4 or 5 nights a week. And bit by bit, the control started to slide. And like really, it got to a point where I probably would do a blood test every couple of days. I couldn't even tell I mean, I'd always do a blood test and it was always high. It was never normal, right? It was always high. Which kind of led me into a sort of an emotional spiral of like, God Almighty, you don't care about yourself. You don't look after yourself. You're not good enough. You're not strong enough. You're not bothered. Why would anyone else be bothered? And you kind of go through this emotional roller coaster for about 20 minutes, and you'd be quite exhausted at the end of it, berating yourself, full of self-loathing and lack of self-confidence. And with that, you didn't really want to do too many blood sugars. And whatever the number was, I couldn't tell you how I got there. I couldn't tell you how I could get it down. I had sort of not just lost control of the diabetes, I'd lost the ability to understand how to control the diabetes. And it was really here that I just stuck my head in the sand. And it was then easy for me to, go out every night of the week and leverage into sort of coping mechanisms of drinking a bit too much. And using that to sort of just suppress everything and just hide everything. And in doing that, I kind of got myself into a sort of road of self-denial. And it came to an abrupt bump just as I was about to fly out to Qingdao for the Clipper around the World Yacht Race. And I was just clipping my fingernails. And they looked a bit weird. So I picked one of the nails up and I crushed it into a powder between my two fingers. And I'd love to tell you, I am Superman and I have these special powerful pincers. I don't. It was actually the nail was not right. And I instinctively knew that was the diabetes. And when I discovered that, I told my wife, who is an amazing researcher. And whilst I was crossing the North Pacific, she emailed me and said, I found a doctor, this chap called Richard Bernstein, and we're going there in August. It's going to be 3 full days of retraining, and flights are booked. So as soon as you get back from the Clipper, you've got to read his book called The Diabetic Solution, which is a big book, and it's a heavy book, but there's a lot of gold in it. And I read it, and I went out to see him, and he changed my life, totally changed my life. And when I met him on day one, he hit me with all the big stuff. Now, the only good thing about me when I was out of control was I always injected. So there was always insulin in my body. There was never a point where there was nothing there and there was really these kind of crazy high blood sugars. So I probably did about three, four a day. He suddenly wanted me to do six minimum. In that if there's corrections during the day, it may go up to 7, 8 to 10. And he stopped me eating carbohydrates. Now, you know, no bread, no pasta, and I'm Irish, no potatoes. No potatoes. I was shunned by my family, my friends, and my country. That was a huge turn. And then also, I never really ate vegetables. So he said, you got to eat protein and green vegetables. And I just ate potatoes and meat pretty much for 40 years. So this was a huge change. And then everything had to be recorded. And he hit me with another few elements. And I remember almost walking out on the day. And my wife convinced me to stay for the full day. And we got to the train station, and as we started coming back, I remember just talking to myself going, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't not eat rice, I can't not eat pasta, I can't do all those injections, I can't deal with all of this. You know, there was medication for thyroid, there was all sorts of stuff. And I just said, I can't do it, there's no way, it's not happening. And my wife, when we got back to Brooklyn, told me, listen, I want you to go down to the pub, I'm going to give you this notebook and a pen, and I just want you to write. Get yourself a pint, just write. And I started to write, I can't, I can't, I can't. And I probably wrote for about 20 minutes, and my hand was cramping up. And I sort of sat back, and I took a sort of sip of the pint. And I suddenly had a thought in my head. It just said, what if you could? And then with that, then to a question, what do you want? What do you want with your life and your life as a diabetic? And that's when everything changed for me. And I went back into him and I did everything that he told me to do, even though it sounded all wrong. It went against an awful lot of stuff I'd been told up to that point from both Dublin and London. And really the driving thing for me was at the back of my mind was, Dr. Bernstein was, or is, he passed this year, unfortunately, but he was a type 1 diabetic. He got it when he was 11, and he became a doctor at 40 because none of his doctors were listening to him. And he took a whole new methodology into diabetes, and with that, he'd been practicing that for decades. And he died just recently at 90 years of old, 90 years of age. He was the oldest living diabetic in the United States, and he had no problems.
So if we can just look at why do you think then the NHS advocates still to have slow acting carbs as part of your diet?
So first of all, the NHS is phenomenal. It is incredible. What it does every single day absolutely blows me away. And if the NHS had unlimited resources, they could do all sorts of stuff, and I'm sure that they would love to do all sorts of additional stuff. But the powers that be, and it's not just the NHS, it's kind of globally, like it's not specifically the NHS take this approach. A lot of countries take this approach. And in trying to change something that's set up like that, it's like turning a super oil tanker. It's a very slow process. But the thing with, carbohydrates, they're variables. And if you remove that variable, you suddenly have a lot less sort of movement on your blood sugars because carbohydrates, it's very easy. I'm sure you remember, right? When you first got diagnosed, you go to the dietitian and they pick up, let me see if I've got something here. They pick up something like this and they go, "This is a potato, and that potato is approximately 70 grams of carbohydrate." Now, 2 weeks later, that potato could be twice the size of that, and you're still convinced it's 70 grams of carbohydrate. But if you eat that, the impact on your blood sugar is going to be enormous. Whereas if you overeat on your protein and your greens, the impact is very, very small. And in removing those variables, you remove the big numbers that cause the big impact. Now, when he first discussed this with me, I used to do a lot of triathlons. And I had been trained or told, like, you need to eat big bowls of pasta to ensure you've got enough energy to keep going. And he said, you don't need that, actually. You don't need anywhere near that. And we, as a race, overconsume carbohydrates enormously. So I kind of went with him, but I didn't believe him. Because, the food manufacturers had done a really good job on me. But when I went to Everest Base Camp, I did that on literally eggs, protein shakes, cabbage. Cabbage grows everywhere. You ever got a problem with cabbage? Get over it, because if anything happens to planet Earth, you're going to get cabbage somewhere. And then whatever meat I could get. All right. And I consume about the equivalent of 12 grams of carbohydrate for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That's it. Nothing else. And I completed Everest Base Camp. And at times we were walking up to 12 hours in a day. And I'd only take small amounts of Lucozade just to keep the blood sugars up. But otherwise, that's it. So if you remove carbohydrates, you can have a massive impact on your blood sugars. But it is initially difficult because it'll feel like first of all, your plate size shrinks down quite a bit, but you won't feel hungry. So if you're getting the protein, you quite easily you'll feel satiated from 6, 7 in the morning till one in the afternoon. And I quite frequently will only have breakfast and dinner. And I have no problems with that at all. So carbohydrates, if you can remove them, I know it's a difficult thing. A lot of people would shirk at the idea, like of, I mean, especially if you're Irish, no potatoes. But you can do it. But you need to sort of, if you want to do it and really engage with it, it's something that you don't want to sort of jump on and jump off. If you do it, adopt it as a lifestyle.
What does your team say, your diabetes team in the UK? What's their
I think when they see the numbers, they're in awe, right? They're just in shock. And like generally, like with the Dexcom or the Libre, they want to get you in range 75% of the time. I'm generally in range about 93.
So what are you offering to other people now? Talk about what you do these days.
With the work that I'm doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so as you pick up, I've gone through quite a journey on this road. And one of the things was what really hit me very hard was that moment in that pub in Brooklyn where I suddenly went from I can't to I can do this. And in that moment, I sort of rather than, oh, this is a diet and I've got to do this and I've got to do this is who I am. This is my lifestyle. This is what I'm about. This is what I need to do. And you just get on with it. Now, I have bad days, but I've also got moments, sort of, I know sometimes I get up in the morning. The very first thing I do is I do a blood test. I check it against the Dexcom. Are they aligned? Yeah. Or do I need to calibrate it? And then I immediately do three injections. And sometimes I just get up and I go, Not today. Right? And I know when I'm like that, I just need to step outside, lash and rain or not, breathe a bit, allow myself to relax, and then just get on with it. Now, it's easy to say, just get on with it. It's tough. It's very tough. And I've been there, like certainly when I was out of control, where you're just exasperated, you're overwhelmed, and you can feel like almost like you're getting diabetes burnout. Taking you through sort of, you know, what is it you want? What's stopping you? What's stopping? What are the stoppers and blockers? Why can't you do this? And we dig into that. And then we do an awful lot of work around the language and the subconscious mind. And then I give you an awful lot of tips and sort of processes that will help in the day-to-day management of diabetes. But certainly, like, you know, it's a tough disease. And, you know, anyone who sort of treats it as, you know, it's easy. Well, there's no problems. There's no chance. You really haven't got a chance. And as well, the systems aren't perfect. I mean, they may get better, but, you know, AI is a suggestion it's going to take over and it'll manage your whole diet. AI does not know that you just suddenly fancy eating that chocolate bar. It just doesn't know it. If you don't change your behavior, and this is really where I talk about the mindset and being, you know, leaning into the lifestyle. If you don't change that, you're constantly going to feel like you're on a, sorry, you're sacrificing everything. And you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this. And you need to sort of step out of that and step away from it. But certainly, I mean, you know, I would suggest every diabetic at some point talks to somebody who counsel can help them through that process. And certainly, like attending my workshops, that's literally what I do. That's the bread and butter of what I do. So does that explain it to you?
Yeah, I think, and you know, we run health days and webinars, and it's great if people will get involved, interact, want to learn. But as you know, an awful lot of people go, well, I don't want to know. I, you know, I don't want to do much about this. I don't want to understand. I just want to take my pills, or, you know, it is difficult getting some people to engage, isn't it?
It's very difficult. And actually, you know, there's a large proportion of people who fall into that, unfortunately, a large proportion of diabetics. So it's one of the really bad things or difficult things that with diabetes. It's so insidious. It's so incredibly slow in the damage that it does. By the time it gets to the point where you're picking up on it, you've done so much damage. So it's really trying to get a hold of these people beforehand. And, you know, it's tough. It's very tough. And that head in the sand and using coping mechanisms to keep yourself connected, really, or grounded, if you want, in a very false term. So what I did is I set up Diabetes Take Control, and it's a company really where I do an awful lot of posting on TikTok and Instagram, talking about diabetes and the information that I got from Dr. Bernstein, which is quite unique, but again, available in his book, The Diabetic Solution. And I also then deal a lot with the emotional and mental health side of diabetes, because it is a very difficult disease to live with. And you know, the approach that I've taken with this is a full day, but I'm looking potentially at splitting that up into smaller bite chunks, so that people can attend courses more easily. But I deal sort of a lot with really getting down into the deep, dark, motivational sort of foundations of who you are and what you want to do and what you're about, to looking at the way you talk to yourself, and like literally those little conversations about, you know, when you do a blood test and you suddenly go, it's crap, I obviously don't care about myself, I don't look after myself. And I've totally changed that around. So if I have a bad blood test, it just provides me with information that allows me to take corrective action that enables me to live a long and healthy life. And how much more empowering is that compared to what I used to do, where I'd be tearing lumps out of myself for 20 minutes. And in changing this sort of approach, you open up so much more angles on living a really long and healthy life. And another one, like I talk about as well, is a thing called the gap, which I refer to. And it's just that moment between having a stimulus and responding to the stimulus and just taking a second and saying, right, rather than getting all upset and angry with myself, take a moment and just say, that's a bit of information. Let's use it and let's take it away and see what we can do to improve my life with diabetes. So I deal with a huge amount of that sort of stuff. You can find me on www.diabetestakecontrol.com, and you can email me at simon@diabetestakecontrol.com as well. And I'll give you details as well if you'd like to get in touch. And I run webinars every now and then, and I'm starting to do an awful lot of talks for corporations, sitting in lunch and learns and running workshops for corporations as well. So I'm on a mission to impact as many diabetics as possible, to give them a bit of a smile on their face, and also to be aware, like, it's not easy. It's not easy. And, you know, I have tough days. Yeah. And I have days like where I just want to have a couple of pints. And I only drink Amstel because it works well with my blood sugars. But
the beers are available.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important. Like, you know, there's a you need to vent at times. So it's very important, and it's also okay, you know. It's all right to have a drink and just relax, sit back. No, it's not my go-to per se, but I'd rather go for a climb or go boxing.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes, the DRWF podcast. Our thanks to Simon McKee for sharing his personal story of living with type 1 diabetes, and in particular its impact on emotional and mental health. A reminder that cutting out carbohydrates altogether is not recommended by healthcare professionals. You can find lots of useful guidance on this and other aspects of diabetes, together with helpful information and details on how to support the charity, plus the latest news, events and fundraising on our website at drwf.org.uk. This is Claire Levy from Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. Our thanks again to Simon for talking to us, and also to you for listening to this latest edition of Living with Diabetes.
Living with Diabetes is a Blue Aurora media production for DRWF. Copyright 2026, Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. All rights reserved.